Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Wednesday, February 4th. As measles cases climb among the unvaccinated in South Carolina, we recall the history of measles and vaccinations during the Hawaiian Kingdom. Measles took the lives of Tu'ali. And when disaster strikes, will you be prepared? We learn about the challenges of stocking up on food and water. On this week's Manu Minute, we meet a chatty bird whose song can last for 20 minutes. Can you believe it? Plus, we tour a high school workshop where special education students are raising money for their program by designing apparel. And the Catholic Church just marked the feast day of St. Marianne. How relics of Mother Marianne Cope of Molokai will soon be shared across the state. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The United Kingdom is one of six European countries that recently lost its measles elimination status. And health experts say the U.S. will likely lose its status this spring. The decisive factor is if the country has had continuous spread of the disease for a year. Outbreaks in Texas and now South Carolina have been driven by unvaccinated people. Hundreds of cases have been confirmed so far, and health officials are monitoring a positive case in a child who visited California's Disneyland. Amid this news, we've been sharing stories about Hawaii's ali'i, who died of measles on a trip to London 202 years ago. An exhibit at the British Museum is drawing attention to that ill-fated voyage of King Liholiho and Queen Kamamalu. As we reflect on that time, we thought it fitting to check with Iolani Palace. The Friends of Iolani Palace operates the museum, and during tours, they mention the tragic voyage of a kingdom crossing oceans to solidify ties with Great Britain. After the deaths of the monarchs, the Hawaiian Kingdom would go on to require vaccinations of their people and would fine the subjects if they didn't protect themselves. We talked to Zito Kapchoi, historian with the Friends of Iolani Palace, and we also heard from curatorial assistant Chase Benbow. In recent years, the palace has expanded its stories tied to the politics of the time. Choi begins with a historical perspective on the measles.
It was a huge concern for a lot of people, and beginning of the 19th century, there were a lot of epidemics, measles, smallpox, cholera. So anytime any ali'i left Hawaii, there was concern. And I'm sure in the non-royal community, if they had family that was leaving Hawaii, be they Hawaiian, be they non-Hawaiian, there were concerns, not just because of disease, but also because of the transportation issues. Captain Dominus, who built Washington Place, left Hawaii, was expected home by Christmas, never came home, lost at sea. So you're always worried about your family.
And then what can you tell us about the thinking at the time in the kingdom about vaccinations and health, public health?
There was Hawaiian healthcare and Western healthcare. And there is some indication that a lot of the traditional means of dealing with certain diseases, or in particular like broken bones, worked better than Western and imported health. But there was an effort to kind of combine what was working best, what worked best for this particular disease, what worked best for this particular injury. And kahuna lapa'au, or Hawaiian practices of Hawaiian medicine, in many instances had a lot better outcome, because they were based on herbal remedies and prevention rather than fix it after you get sick. But after a major smallpox epidemic in 1853, the Legislative Assembly passed a vaccination law in 1854. Whereas the late mortality caused by smallpox has shown the necessity of compelling a general and effective vaccination of subjects of the kingdom, the Minister of the Interior was to appoint vaccination officers and go to different districts. And every child born after the first day of June 1854 shall, within 6 months after the birth of such child, go to the vaccination clinic and get vaccinated. And you had to go back whatever the time frame is to make sure the vaccination took, because vaccination technology at the time, sometimes it would take, sometimes it wouldn't, and apparently there was a way to judge it.
And were they fined if they didn't get vaccinated?
They were fined $5. And if I didn't vaccinate my kids and you reported me, I paid the fine and you got half.
Well, Chase, why don't you jump in here? Talk about what you studied and how it all plays into this story.
So some of the research we've done, specifically looking at elite traveling abroad, there's this deep understanding that disease has rapidly shaped or really intensely shaped the political, social landscape of the Hawaiian Kingdom, right? So you have our ali'i traveling abroad in 1824 with Kamehameha II and Kamaumalu, and they pass away. And one thing to remember is that King Kamehameha III is his brother, right? So it's a very personal loss for him too, at a time where you have ali'i and maka'ainana who are passing away at a very rapid rate from disease. So these vaccination policies were meant to aggressively deal with these epidemics that had been foreign to Hawaii that were then introduced, and trying to take an understanding of both Western medicine, but then also not forgetting what has already worked in Hawaii as well with the kahuna lapa'au. So, you know, li'i were very intent on passing policies that they felt were gonna decrease the depopulation of the Hawaiian Kingdom. We were looking at ali'i traveling abroad for all sorts of purposes, whether it was for diplomatic reasons, for personal reasons, and there seems to be an underlying theme of sort of concern about health. So, for example, King Kalakaua, when he's traveling around the world, we see him very concerned with a smallpox epidemic that has broken out. And he's actually writing in his letters back home that he's willing to cut his trip early because he's worried about the safety of his people. And that's really important because he's not having this leisurely trip around the world. He's trying to build relations to ensure Hawaii remains independent. And here he's saying, my people come before my political aims. And so he's constantly writing back and forth with his sister, Princess Regent at the time, Lili'u Okalani, and asking her to inform him on what's going on. We have grown up at a time where we don't have to worry that potentially your entire family could die of smallpox. Because of the success of these vaccinations, we grew up not really having to worry about infectious diseases as much as people 150 years ago. So I think to be able to look at the broader scope of even just the history of disease in Hawaii and seeing our ali'i being very proactive in trying to deal with it, it gives you a longer historical perspective to deal with this very foreign thing to us. It's like, okay, we've been here before, we've seen what works and we've seen what doesn't work.
A lot of people were complaining about the quarantine during the COVID pandemic. And in an effort to better understand what was going on in the 19th century, I did some research for our Facebook posts. And I discovered that Hawaii had a quarantine law in 1839. The United States' first quarantine law was 1893, over 50 years later. The quarantine law in Hawaii required a public health official to check out every ship. Were there contagious diseases, or anyone who had suffered from a contagious disease and recovered for the last 4 months before arriving in the harbor? And if there was one case on that ship, it was quarantined for 40 days.
And they were quarantined over at Sand Island, if I recall.
Could be. The quarantine station was at Sand Island, but the higher paying passengers got to stay on the ship. So the ship couldn't go anyplace else until the quarantine was lifted. And there was a quarantine station on what is now Sand Island. And the government kind of took care of them, because one year I discovered that the Royal Hawaiian Band, to entertain the people that were at the quarantine station, went on a barge and round Sand Island playing music for them to entertain them.
And today they are out on your grounds, yeah. Giving a free concert.
Yeah, they are. But quarantine in 1839, this was a way to make sure that the diseases that were being imported from abroad didn't get shared. And the similar thing happened with leprosy, Hansen's disease, quarantined on Molokai, because no one understood how it was transmitted. And the Hawaiians, for some reason, had a greater propensity to suffer from the disease than other ethnic groups. And speaking of leprosy, Chase mentioned looking at smallpox and other diseases as Kalakaua was traveling. He was contacting his sister, basically, but he was also connecting with doctors who had known, who were working with the treatment of leprosy and the care for patients who had leprosy and a possible cure for leprosy in Japan and in another jurisdiction. And the man, Dr. Goto in Japan, actually gave him a bunch of information to send home for the doctors here.
So they were all very much interested in the welfare of the people.
Oh yeah, because Hawaiian ali'i considered themselves in loco parentis. I am the parent of my community. I need to do whatever I can to make sure they are healthy, fed, housed, clothed, educated.
Well, just a stone's throw away from here on Quinn Street is where a lot of the Hawaiians who died of smallpox, you know, are buried. It's tucked away, you know, off in the corner. But, you know, if this is all part of the history that you folks share when people come through the palace.
Yeah, I think of a lot of our focus is, again, looking at the agency of our ali'i. I think a lot of times the history of disease in Hawaii is, it's always seen as reactive in a way, right? That foreigners come, they introduce diseases, and 90% of the population dies. And while that's true, we don't want to forget that our ali'i, and not just our ali'i, but legislatures are working very hard to try to figure out policies that are going to prevent the spread of diseases, to reduce population loss. So even if you can look at newspapers and there's a public information campaign, they're talking about studies done in the United States and Europe about smallpox and vaccinations, and then they're publishing it in newspapers here to show people that, okay, there's this new treatment and we believe it'll be effective. There's a huge government undertaking. If you think about how a vaccination would even come to Hawaii, it's a logistical challenge, right? Coming on a ship, typically from, it could be from London, in some cases it was Aotearoa, and you don't have refrigeration, so you have to get people ready to be vaccinated immediately when it comes. And so the government would publish posts in the paper saying, free vaccinations, come to the government dispensary and we'll take care of you. Which again, right, there's not even a monetary aspect to this, right? It's literally free vaccinations for people because of the monarchy and the government being so concerned that people are actually getting vaccinated. They push out these initiatives that are very, very proactive and very reflective of what we would see with the 2020 COVID pandemic.
Chase mentioned Kalakaua riding home when he was traveling around the world, talking to his sister, the Princess Regent, Lili Okalani, about the smallpox epidemic and asking her questions about it. Well, we said vaccination. This was for children here. Immigrants did not have to be vaccinated when they showed up and landed here. So in 1881, there was a ship that, for some reason, people that were on the ship got off the ship that had smallpox. So it was found in certain areas of Chinatown. The Princess Regent immediately quarantined those blocks of Chinatown and then shut down the ports because she did not want to share smallpox with the outer islands. This caused a lot of complaints in the community, especially the business community, because how can we ship our goods? There was a workaround for that, by which I would drop off stuff on the pier. The crew on the ship, the steamer, would get the stuff off the pier, take it to the outer island, put it on the pier without ever getting off the steamer. And so things were back and forth. But it kind of shut down some business and made it impossible for people to go visit family on other islands.
Yeah. It's not unlike what we experienced through the pandemic and the pushback that we got between the masks and spacing and all of that. Yeah.
But she was more concerned about her community, the health of her community, than the health of the business community.
Fascinating history. The concern of our ali'i about health care brought about the Queen's Medical Center and Kapi'olani Medical Center for Women's and Children. We should note that the palace has two portraits of King Liholiho and Queen Kamamalu on display at the historic home. Lithographs of the Ali'i are also part of the British Museum's exhibit in London. If you want to learn more, there'll be a webinar with Bishop Museum curator Hialoha Johnson and Kate LeMay, formerly of the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery, next week. We'll have links to register on our website after the show.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
Greetings, I'm Lulu Solares, your new Friday night host on After Hours, Hawaii Public Radio's new weeknight late night music space, where each night brings a different host, genre, and point of view after dark. Join me for Mondo Reggae, Worldwide Reggae, past and present. Music to soundtrack your life after hours. Fridays 10 p.m. to midnight on HBR1.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Olson Trust, envisioning a Hawaii where its people are supported by the land, and the land is taken care of by its people. OlsonTrust.com.
Hawaii's food banks took stock of residents' emergency stores this past fall, and it revealed that under a tenth of households facing food insecurity feel prepared for a disaster. That prompted HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote to take a closer look at those findings. She joins us now. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so, I mean, I was trying to remember, I think it used to be like have a week's worth of food, and it's now 2 weeks, right?
Yeah, so 2 weeks is the recommendation you commonly hear from emergency managers, both kind of at the county level and then HAIIMA, the overarching emergency management agency for the state. And we hear this all the time, but data shows that few of us have actually taken steps to do it. So as you mentioned, Hawaii's major food banks, they dug into this topic in their most recent report, and they found that 6%, so a very few number of people who are struggling with hunger have taken steps to make a disaster kit or feel prepared for a disaster. But beyond that, for those of us who aren't struggling with hunger on the day-to-day, not many of us have done this either. Only 21% of adult residents in Hawaii in that category feel prepared for a disaster.
Man, that's kind of scary. So why aren't we doing it?
Well, I spoke about this with Eden Stewart at the Maui Emergency Management Agency, and she says in some cases it's easy to take this kind of disaster preparation for granted if it's actually just never come into play for you.
Take my ohana, for example. You've lived here, you're born here, raised here, lived here your whole life, been through a lot of different things. You know, they're thinking, well, I survived and I didn't need that. I haven't ever had to utilize it. And so sometimes those are the hardest people to convince, you know, that this needs to be done and that you have to at least have that because they are already very resilient, right? Or something major hasn't necessarily hit them specifically.
Yeah, so it hasn't happened. Why do we need it?
Yeah, but it doesn't all come down to that sense of complacency that, you know, I myself have fallen prey to in the past. There are real barriers that keep people from building up their supply. So the obvious one is cost, right? Which makes sense when you consider how high grocery prices are in Hawaii. And if you're struggling to feed yourself on the day-to-day, it's not reasonable to expect that you're going to store 14 days of food for some theoretical disaster. As Amy Miller put it when I spoke to her, she's the CEO of the Hawaii Food Bank, if you're food insecure, you're already in disaster mode. And the report that they did on food security in the state really showed that. Interestingly, though, for the households who consider themselves food secure, who aren't dealing with hunger, the main reason why they haven't taken this step wasn't cost. It was storage, actually, like which makes sense when when you take a moment to visualize how much food and water we're talking about for a 14-day supply, say you have a family of four, each of whom are recommended to have 1,500 to 2,000 calories and 1 gallon of water per day for 14 days, that's at least a full groceries cart worth of food and like 56-gallon jugs of water. Like, I really have trouble visualizing where all of that would go in my home. And then the other barriers that people mentioned was they just weren't sure what supplies they should actually be putting in an emergency kit, what's appropriate for this kind of scenario.
Well, I remember interviewing people who would actually put bottled water in cinder blocks, and they would put a cap on it. But that's way, you know, that way they knew they had water in their little block walls. It was pretty innovative, I think.
And I think that those are the creative solutions that emergency managers are hoping people adopt. But if you are struggling with even just where to get started, the first thing that you want to think of is food, right? So in your emergency supply, you're looking for non-perishable, easy-to-store food, right? Maybe you can fit it in that your cinder block wall. That's also nutrient-dense and has a really long shelf life. So nut butters, trail mix, canned tuna, canned Spam, canned soup, canned chili. You're definitely going to want a can opener in your kit. And then try to pick things that don't need a lot of cooking or water, which you may also be rationing in a disaster situation. So like pre-made packaged rice is better than typical rice. Mm-hmm. And then a piece of advice that actually surprised me when we were thinking about food is to include some sort of like significant cultural or comfort food in your kit. So yes, we're planning for a survival scenario, but food isn't purely functional. There's an emotional component to it too. So Elton Ushio with the Kauai Emergency Management Agency says, this could be as simple as having furikake for your rice, if that's how you usually eat it, to give you that kind of sense of normalcy. And then Eden Stewart again with Maui Emergency Management Agency says, again, creativity. Local businesses are coming up with really creative ways to store local food that could be applied to emergency preparation.
I was able to go to a Resiliency Hub Summit, and there was an organization there that is in the process of dehydrating local food. So we had beef luau, which is, you know, the taro leaves cooked down and they were dehydrated, and then they had dehydrated beef. So it was beef luau, which is one of my biggest comfort foods. Not just comfort food, but it's a cultural connection. Could you imagine, though, like if you had a comfort food that your grandma or your mom or somebody made you that just, it didn't matter what you're feeling, you ate that and you just were like, everything may not be okay, but it feels a little bit more palatable in this moment. Just having that comfort item to just help a little bit in those stressful times is really important.
And, you know, folks might think, oh, gosh, if I have to buy, you know, 2 weeks worth of food to store, yeah, what's that going to cost me? But, you know, I know somebody that I talked to said, you know, just when you go to the store, you'd buy an extra bottle of ketchup, you know, that kind of thing. So that way the impact is not so deep on your pocketbook.
Yeah, that is exactly what the emergency managers I go to recommended that you do. Spread out the cost by picking up a can or two of something that you already like to eat, or look at what's on sale, or buy in bulk with a friend or a family member and then divide the items up. That is not what I did. I decided to do this all in one go to get a sense of what 14 days worth of food for one person, which is 28,000 calories, would cost and look like. And I did it at Walmart last week in Honolulu. And I focused on canned beans and veggies and meat, some peanut butter, some trail mix. My comfort food was Rice Krispie Treats. And in total, with tax, it cost $104, which was honestly less than I expected to spend. But I was choosing the most affordable options. I don't really have any dietary restrictions. And I didn't even try to get water. Like, I didn't open that can of worms. And this was just for me, one person. So you can think that that cost is going to quickly stack up if you're trying to prepare for a whole family. So spreading it out is a really good strategy so that you don't have all that cost up front. It also spreads out the expiration dates of your food, something
yes.
that they encourage people to be mindful of. And, you know, they also say pick things that you actually want to eat, because as this expiration date comes up, you're going to want to rotate that food out into your regular meal so it doesn't go to waste.
Well, you know, aside from the guy that's putting bottles of water in his cinder block, what are some other tips?
Yeah, that's really daunting. So the advice that I got was, rather than buy water, all of your water supply in plastic bottles, invest in some reusable containers that you can fill up ahead of a disaster. So there are things called water bobs or bladders that fit in your bathtub. The Department of Water Supply on Oahu, they give out free reusable bags, 2.5-gallon bags, for anyone who wants them. Sol Konoho with Kauai Emergency Management Agency, he'll fill up a 30-gallon trash can with water if there's a big event on the horizon. And he'll treat it so it's safe to drink, or he'll use the water to water his plants if the storm passes. And again, the recommendation is 1 gallon a day. That's for cooking, drinking, and hygiene, but very bare bones for each of these. So pick foods that don't need a lot of water, and put some wet wipes in your kit to reduce the amount of water you need for personal cleaning.
Yeah, all good tips. And I know one really good one was to put your canned food in the order of expiration up first, so you use those so they, you know, don't go to waste. But thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was HPR Savannah Harriman-Pope talking about the two-week supply of food and water that emergency management officials recommend that you have on hand in the event of a disaster. Time now for the Manu Minute with University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart. You may not recognize this week's bird on sight, but if you spent time in Hawaii's high elevation forest, chances are you know the call of the Eurasian skylark. Take a listen.
The Eurasian skylark is a very plain-looking bird. They stand about 7 inches high, and both sexes are mostly a mottled brown and tan, with a white stripe above their eye and a short crest on top of their head. These skylarks are widespread across most of Europe and northern Asia, and were first introduced to Oahu in 1870, and were then released to Maui Nui and the Big Island of Hawaii by the early 1900s, mainly because of their beautiful song, which is a complex series of trills, warbles, and whistles. On Oahu, they can sometimes be found in grassy areas near the airport and around Pearl Harbor. They're most abundant, though, in high-elevation grasslands on Haleakala, Mauna Loa, and Mauna Kea. Eurasian skylarks are a bit famous in European literature and music for their impressive display flights. During the breeding season, the males will take off from the ground and fly up in a steep spiral to 300 feet high, where they hover and circle for up to 5 minutes. Energetically singing and fluttering their wings the entire time. Because they're so high up, this song can be heard from a long ways away, so it's become a really common sound to anyone who spends much of their time in our Mauka grasslands above the forest line. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the Hilo Department of Biology.
You know, we've heard from many of you about recent segments that you liked and didn't like and wanted to share some feedback. We received this message from Sharon Dillard about our interview with Hawaii Republican Party Chair Shirlene Ostroff yesterday. She writes, "Thank you so much for interviewing this Trump supporter and your excellent questions. Of interest to me was her concern for the people on the Waianae Coast and all the keiki who are struggling with cutbacks to food and health care since Trump. She also dislikes some things that he said that are disrespectful. No mention of the cold-blooded murders of American citizens like her. I'm a fairly recent naturalized citizen, here legally from Canada 19 years ago on a work permit. I married an American, which is the only way to do it unless you're rich. There's no line to wait in." We also heard from many of you about a recent What's in Your Cart segment featuring a woman named Eileen on Oahu's North Shore who believed the economy was headed in the right direction. And Alan Anderson writes, it's hard to get much nuance from sound bites like these. Isn't that part of why we listen to HPR, to get a more developed and thought out understanding? Even though I don't think tariffs and the capricious punitive way this administration wields them will help the economy, I'd like to know the reasons that she does. And Clarissa Oliva says, one of the beauties of Hawaii Nei, agree to disagree and still be aloha. Isn't that the very essence of how our culture came to be? The plantation fields, Hawaiians, Filipinos, Japanese, Chinese, Koreans, Puerto Ricans, Irish, etc., sharing our food, all learning how to get along. Everybody has one thing in common, taking care of family. And in response to our coverage of the British Museum exhibit, Hawaii, A Kingdom Crossing Oceans, we heard from Larry Rose on Facebook. He writes, an even-handed discussion of a very complex and sensitive issue. I visited the British Museum back in the mid-1980s, specifically looking for the displayed Hawaiian artifacts. Apparently things there are much improved. At least now there was participation and input from some native Hawaiian cultural practitioners. Back in the day, our Namea Kapuna were badly displayed, most as loot of conquest and often misattributed. The British Museum should be recognized for their efforts to get it right, but they still need to return them back to Hawaii Nei. They can keep the reproductions and return the actual Hawaiian items. We do appreciate your feedback. We encourage you to leave a voicemail on our talkback line. That number, 808-792-8217. You can also find us on Facebook or Instagram, or email us your thoughts at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
After all the jets are in the boxes, and the clowns have all gone to bed.
You know, a t-shirt display caught our eye recently. Special education students at Kaimuki High School have been designing and printing custom apparel to raise money for their program and learn vocational skills in the process. It comes in the wake of federal cuts to education totaling billions of dollars. The Conversation's Kevin Allen recently took a tour of the Kaimuki High School workshop where students use silkscreen printing to detail shirts and uniforms. He spoke with special education teacher Ryan Swinehart about how the vocational program prepares students for life after high school.
So a big thing that we want to teach our kids is the vocational process, right? So we know that a lot of our kids, they don't specifically want to get into the field of making t-shirts, but what we do want to teach them is the work readiness skills that go along with any job. Because for any job, right, you got to show up on time, show up every day, make sure you're properly dressed for the job, of course, you know, and just being able to work for X amount of time, be able to take instruction or direction, whether it's positive or negative criticism from employers. And sometimes you have multiple employers, right? So we have multiple teachers and EAs and paraprofessionals that help with that process. So a lot of it is just helping our kids try to learn all those work readiness skills.
And I think it's really interesting too, kind of the foil around this, or a lot of this project, is to maybe help stymie some of these federal budget cuts to a lot of the Department of Education. Expand a little bit more about that.
Well, when it comes down to funding, a lot of what we're doing here isn't necessarily to build money. There is a very, very small minimal profit margin. So most of what we make, one, goes back into the program, right, so that it can be fully self-sustaining. That way, as we go on years and years, the goal is we're able to keep going without needing extra special funding from the state. And whatever small amounts of profit margin we do make, it'll go straight to the classroom, whether it's for buying school equipment, pens, pencils, et cetera, or providing a small budget for CBI, which is our community-based instruction. So our students are able to go out in the community and practice those community skills.
I guess kind of just bringing it back a little bit, how did this get started? Where did this idea come from? Why did you guys decide to initiate this program?
So this program actually started way before I was even a teacher. It was actually started when I was still a student here. Back in the day, there was Scott Shibuya, who was our, I believe, graphics arts teacher at the time. And he first started trying to do this silkscreen printing as a way to, you know, help his students with the graphics art side of things. Eventually, it got passed down to Reed Yoshikawa, who is our current athletic director. And he used to be the special education teacher here in this classroom, where he kind of started it up. He really made the bulk of it, because that's when he really started getting a lot of orders, whether it's through majority through schools and some nonprofits outside. But he was doing it all with just a manual silkscreen printing press. Eventually, when our old AD retired, he applied to be the new AD. And from there, I took over the program. And during that time, that's when this work-based learning initiative started within the Hawaii DOE. Basically, that's where we're pushing all of our special education students to try to get them to be more work ready rather than just sending them off to just a day program when they leave. That's where we got all these fundings, and I was able to really get all these new equipments, because one of the things is when they go out to the real world, they're going to have all these new updated equipment. So that's where we started, okay, we got to get the same thing that they're going to see in the real world, right? So that way we can practice, you know, on the real thing.
Tell me, I guess, the breadth of the products or the things that are being made here.
Yeah, so the t-shirts definitely is the main thing that we make. We can make other things because all of our machines, we can print on other things. So we can do things like scarves, obviously t-shirts, hats. You can print on any kind of clothing material, any apparel, really. We do a lot of hats for our embroidery machines. That's probably one of the more popular ones. That's the bulk of what we make. A lot of it is through custom orders too. It's all custom apparel. So whenever people come with us, we're usually creating brand new designs.
Where are you guys getting these custom orders from? Like, who's reaching out?
So a lot of what we're making is for, one, our own school. So all the different programs within our own school, we always try to get our own school first, whether it's clubs, sports teams, different programs happening. We also do work with a lot of other schools within our complex area. So we make a lot for like elementary schools, like Alawai Elementary. We've worked with them multiple times, Jarrett Middle School. And it's the same thing. They're programs that they have within their schools, clubs, sports. And then we'll do some nonprofits within the community. So one of the big ones that we do is with one of our good friends, Nainoa, at Friends of the Library. So they do their Friends of the Library event every year, and they always come back to us. We make t-shirts for them. And then we'll make here and there other nonprofits. A lot of it is word of mouth that we get. We try not to, you know, advertise too much because we're not trying to compete with other local businesses. So a lot of it is just trying to help out the community and, of course, the DOE.
And I think beyond just the money and the products and the skills, do the kids enjoy it?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, one of the big things we do with our kids, like we don't force all of our kids to participate in this program. It's more so directed based on what their personal goals are. So if the kids want to do something that's more on the hands-on side, this is probably the closest thing we have to those hands-on things, even if it might not necessarily be shirts, just getting used to being in a shop environment, things like that. We do offer other opportunities, like we have a coffee cart. So kids that want to go more towards like the retail side or maybe like the food side for our special ed kids, you know, we have the coffee cart. And then, of course, like with Miss Chu at the Worms Club. So it depends on really where they want to go, what they're interested in.
Could you tell me a little bit more, I guess, about the mindset behind why you're really trying to tailor these programs for just the future of what these kids might want to get into looking past high school?
Looking at what we want our kids to do in the future, a big reason to why we do these programs is, one, from my end as a special ed teacher, in the past, a lot of kids with disabilities, they struggle after they leave high school because there's only so many adult day programs. There's limitations on how much they can take, and then there are requirements for them to be able to enter those programs, right? And a lot of kids, you know, they slip through the cracks because they don't necessarily meet the requirements, or it's just bad timing on them, things like that. And that's why we want to help them build these skills so that when they do leave, there's more opportunities out there for them. So we work a lot with DVR, Department of Vocational Rehabilitation. So they work with kids with disabilities and helping them with job training and getting jobs. And that kind of helped build into why we started this. So one of the places that they have a program for is Lana Kila. We like to feed our kids to Lana Kila because they actually have a program that creates t-shirts just like this. So that was one of the drives behind why we started this, particularly with these t-shirts and the silkscreen printing. So that way they can transition there. So yeah, that's the big fuel why we want to help our kids move forward and when they leave. Because the reality is, they're not, even for our gen ed kids, not everyone is going to go to college. And we're trying to let our kids know that that's okay. If that's not your path, that's all right. But as long as you have something that you're passionate about, something that, you know, you're driven for, and, you know, that there's careers out there that don't necessarily involve college all the time, and we want to help them get there. And we have a few other students that they're not working particularly in Lanakila or a shirt business, but we have other students that are finding other work programs out there that they're taking the skills that we've used or that they learned here out there, you know, which is really great because seeing results, at least for me, since I've only been here officially 2 years, just to see results quickly like that, it's a good feeling to see. And it's nice to see how this actually makes a difference for these kids because, you know, when I think about it, if we didn't do this, they might not be finding a program through DVR and they might just be stuck at home, just living with mom and dad and that's it. So, you know, it's great to see that.
What you said is really true. At this point in their life, it's really a time where you can make a difference and you can help prepare them for the future. I guess as an educator and as a teacher and as a coach yourself, how does that really make you feel knowing that you can make that difference?
Honestly, I mean, that means everything. Because if it wasn't for things like that, I probably still wouldn't be here, you know? Because that's the real reason why a lot of teachers, coaches, we do this, right? Because the reality is the pay is not necessarily there as a coach and as a teacher, but the passion is there. And that's why most teachers love what they do. And that's why I do it too, right? I'm here to help the kids for a better future. Even with coaching, whenever I talk to other people about coaching too, I tell people like, I'm not in it for the money. I enjoy it because it makes me feel good, which is selfish, but it's like in a non-selfish way, right? We're here to help our kids grow, to help them mature. And when we see them successful out there and we see kids come back and come visit us and they're like, hey, mister, thank you so much for all this, blah, blah, blah. It means a lot. You know, it's just knowing that you actually help someone and it gives you some meaning.
That was Kaimuki High School special education teacher Ryan Swinehart and HBR's Kevin Allen. We'll have photos of the students' creations on our website after today's show.
Support for HPR comes from NAREIT Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping families of agricultural workers and retirees with affordable housing, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation, NAREITHawaii.com.
Let the games begin. This week, the 2026 Winter Olympics get started in Italy. They are coming, though, with a dose of controversy. Construction projects are clouded by allegations of corruption.
Actually, it has been the norm until now, this non-transparency and almost complete unaccountability.
Hear that story next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1, here on HPR 1.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
The Catholic community celebrated the feast day of St. Marianne last month. Mother Marianne Cope was canonized as a saint in 2012 because of her work with Hansen's disease patients at Kalaupapa. Her remains are at the Cathedral Basilica of Our Lady of Peace here in Honolulu. But the Order of Nuns at Kalaupapa reached out recently to Chaminade University's Forensic Sciences Unit. They were asking for help to examine the soil from the area where Mother Marianne's remains were exhumed. Bishop Larry Silva paid a visit to the laboratories recently, and the diocese says work is underway to have the additional relics on display in parishes across the state. Carlos Gutierrez Ayala is an assistant professor at Chaminade and director of Chaminade's forensic unit. He talked about how science and the church were able to team up on this unusual project.
Some member of the sister of the Catholic Church, they approached to us to ask if they can use the forensic anthropologist, he's working with them, can use our facilities to process some soil graves from the grave of Saint Marianne, which I say, of course, yes. I asked for the permission from my dean, and of course she agrees. And also we ask, though, if some student can participate in this process because it's a real case. And of course they agree, so I asked if some volunteer students, so I have two students who volunteer in this work. which consists in pretty much they bring some bags with soil and they need to separate and check if in that soils they have some bone fragments or coffin fragments, which is a really meticulous process to do. So they use instrumental, we have microscopes, some special lights, and they spend over a week to process just a few, maybe half a gallon bags of soil, which was a tremendous success. So we were able to get a lot of bone fragments from Sainte Marianne, which in the next few months probably they'll make some special relics, which is the word they use in the Catholic Church, to have at least one per each island, which is the idea from the bishop.
And this is really a unique opportunity because you're able to use science and the church teachings and get the students involved in a project like this.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why you probably were just a few forensic scientists in the world to be able to work with the Catholic Church in some of their saints' remains, which is unique. And also is the combine the science with the church, any church, but with religion, is a unique opportunity. So it's not really common you have that opportunity to mix both worlds in one, in benefit, of course, to the community. One of the interesting facts of Sainte Marianne, which I learned over this time, she was a science person. So she was a nurse, she was she take care of patients. Actually, the first Bill of Rights of the patient is in the US is made by Sainte Marianne. So she was really important in the health community in the country, so that also is important. So it's interesting how we connect all of that. And also a really interesting fact as well, the last day we finished work with her remains was her birthday. So it was an interesting fact.
And Bishop Silva came here. I mean, this was a project that they have very keen interest because Mother Marianne Cope's remains are mainly at the cathedral, but then this allows Catholics from other communities just to be able to interact with these relics.
That's right. So Father Bishop Larry, yes, that is his idea, and of course the sister's idea as well. So if you live in other island and you don't have the opportunity to come to Honolulu, you cannot see the remains or worship the remains of Sainte Marianne. That will change. That is the idea will change in the probably this year. So the idea from Bishop is at least each island have at least one remains, one reliquary of Sainte Marianne. So that is the goal.
And so this was a project that you folks were able to embark on partly because a previous director here at the center, right, had done work exhuming the remains of not just Mother Marianne, but then Father Jamian.
Correct. So the forensic anthropologist who was in charge of this project, his name is Vin Sava. He was a faculty member here several years ago as an adjunct. So actually, he was one of my professors when I did my master here. And he approached to me to ask me for this, if we can help in that way. And of course, we were open because it's part of our job also to be open to the community, help to the community, because we generate knowledge here, of scientific knowledge based on, of course, forensic sciences. And one of our main goals is help the Hawaiian community. We prepare the future forensic scientists, not just for the state, it's for the whole country. And sometimes we have international students like myself, and we prepare also them.
And you folks have been able to provide opportunities, internships for your students here, right? They've been at the medical examiner's office for the city and county, or even the military's POW, MIA, defense agency?
Correct. Because we are the only forensic science program in the state and one of the oldest program in the nation, this is our 30th anniversary, we are able to, and the students, it's a mandatory, they need to have a mandatory internship. So that opens a lot of doors for us to contact the other agencies in the state, but also outside the state. So the students have the capability to go there and see how the real life work is and how they well prepared are. So we have a student, they usually do the internship at the medical examiner office, at Honolulu Police Department, Maui Police Department. We have a few students who had internship in FBI, and they got a job after that, of course. We have alumni in NCIS here, in DPA as well. So probably the 60% of the investigators are the medical examiner office in Honolulu are Chaminade alumni. So we feed all the public institutions, not only in the state, around the country, with our forensic scientists. So they're well prepared.
So I don't know, the fact that you have been able to be a part of this center that creates these opportunities for our young people, and to have this unique project come through our doors here.
Yeah, this is a unique, of course, the experience I have myself as a forensic scientist, over 22 years of experience working in different cases. I have myself over 6,000 cases in my career, from everything, so mass disaster, are of course other type of cases. The other faculties as well, they have a vast experience in forensic science as well in different agencies around the country, which make this program unique. So the degree we offer is really wide open to options for the student. Why I'm saying that? Because our degree is a pre-med degree as well. So the student can go to med school. They can go to law school. We have a few students who are going to law school soon. Also, they are prepared to work in the lab as a chemistry or in DNA lab or in biology or toxicology, but also they are well prepared to be an investigator if they like the field work. In comparison with other programs we have in the nation, we're probably one of the more wide open variety, so we provide the tools for all the students to be prepared for everything. In other programs, you are just prepared for toxicology or just prepared for DNA, for example. But we prepare the student for every option, so they can work any place they need or they like, of course. And we give that, which is a unique opportunity for the students. And that is the feedback we usually have from them. We have, actually, yesterday I got an email from one student. She started working in LA lab. In Los Angeles, in the lab department over there, which is a huge department. It's the oldest police department in the nation as well. So it's a unique opportunity for her, and she felt really well prepared to work there.
Yeah, well, this is terrific now that you're marking the 30th anniversary of the center. Yeah, with this particular case. It's terrific.
This is our 30th year providing this service to the community, forming forensic scientists to the world, which is a nice way to serve the community, to help others. Sometimes others, they are no longer with us, and we are their voice. And that is something I talk with the students all the time. You're responsible to allow that person is no longer with us, have a voice, and put all the evidence necessary to solve that case or helping the justice system.
So whether it's a criminal case or just something helping with identification, like at the military's labs, right? It's, yeah, you feel like you've got some purpose.
Yes, yes, yeah. We serve the community. Yeah. And that's it.
And that was Carlos Gutierrez Ayala, director of the Forensic Sciences Unit at Chaminade University, who interestingly got his start as a police officer in Chile. The diocese is working with Chaminade and is planning to take the relics to other islands later this year, so stay tuned. Well, we have to go now, but up tomorrow, we plan to learn how Iolani Palace is celebrating Hawaiian Language Month with tours in Olelo, Hawaii, and more. Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Search for archive shows on our website or as a podcast on Spotify and Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.